from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Judge Neil Gorsuch of the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Colorado has a gold-plated academic resume and a sterling reputation as a very conservative judge. The question for the Senate now, after President Trump's nomination last night, is Judge Gorsuch the right judge now for the court and the country? And for Democrats who saw Judge Merrick Garland absolutely stonewalled, what to do? This hour on Point in our 100-day spotlight, the High Court, the Senate, and Judge Neil Gorsuch. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you want to know about this new nominee, and what should the Democrats do? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Conservatives absolutely celebrating. Last night in an interview with CNN, Texas Senator Ted Cruz praised the new nominee.
It was an absolute home run. It's the most important decision that President Trump has made in the 2 weeks he's been in office. In the course of the campaign, he promised the American people that he would nominate a principled constitutionalist to replace Justice Scalia. And tonight, in nominating Judge Gorsuch, President Trump has honored that commitment. He's kept his word to the American people.
Senator Nancy Pelosi, minority leader there, in her CNN, or Nancy Pelosi, I should say, in her CNN town hall last night, saw it quite differently.
It's a very hostile appointment. Hail fellow, well met, lovely family, I'm sure. But as far as your family is concerned, and all of if you breathe air, drink water, eat food, take medicine, or in any other way interact with the courts, this is a very bad decision, well outside the mainstream of American legal thought.
House Minority Leader, of course, Nancy Pelosi there, and Donald Trump, kind of a reality TV flourish to his introduction of the new nominee.
So was that a surprise? Was it?
Big crowd, lots of applause there in the White House last night. And here Donald Trump saying he's keeping a promise here.
Today I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court.
And Judge Gorsuch stepped to the microphone, talked about his hero, Justice Antonin Scalia.
Justice Scalia was a lion of the law. Agree or disagree with him, all of his colleagues on the bench cherish his wisdom and his humor. And like them, I miss him.
And what does it take to be the right kind of judge? Here was the nominee.
When we judges don our robes, it doesn't make us any smarter. But it does serve as a reminder of what's expected of us. Impartiality and independence. Collegiality and courage.
We're going to look at the judge, what his confirmation would mean for the balance of philosophy on the high court, and at how Democrats are likely to respond after the nearly year-long stonewalling of Judge Merrick Garland, who, of course, was nominated last March by then-President Barack Obama. Joining us first today from Washington is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
How do you describe the profile of this nominee?
Well, he is a conservative federal appeals court judge. He's been there about 10 years. I should admit up front, Tom, that I have a real bias in this area, which is I read a lot of court opinions and have to write about them.
Yes.
And Neil Gorsuch is a terrific writer. And my colleagues and I who cover the court, I think, are biased in favor of
everybody
good writers.
Says so. Everybody says this guy can really write.
No, he really – it really is the case, Tom. If you got together a group of opinions and a group of friends – and sat and read them, they're not all the same. A lot of judges are really not very good writers. They string together a lot of snippets of opinions. This guy understands the law and wants to explain it to you, and he writes very clearly. He sort of explains the whole area of the law, why the court's ruling the way it is, why that's the right decision. So he's a very impressive appeals court judge, and I think in any Republican administration, that is, if this were the Mitt Romney or Jeb Bush administration, he would be right at the top of the list. Much of the criticism last night when I was reading about him, there are two names that always come to the fore. Donald Trump, he's Donald Trump's appointee, and Merrick Garland, the very capable judge who was not given a hearing. But if you just looked at his opinions and his record, Neil Gorsuch is an exceptionally good judge.
He's a very good writer. He's a very conservative judge. Does he write with the kind of zingers that Antonin Scalia would deliver, both on the page and off?
No. No, there's none of the sort of Scalia sarcasm. There's also not the Scalia showiness. Scalia liked to have a series of lines that, you know, that would sort of jump off the page and say, oh, you've got to quote this. It's one of his real zingers. Neil Gorsuch is much more of a clear explainer of the law, that you could actually follow what he's arguing and trying to show you why, you know, in this conflict of the law, here's the right answer. He's a clear thinker and a good writer.
He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Kennedy, a centrist swing vote, of course, as you describe him. Conservatives, as you say, clearly hope he'll be more like Scalia. How do you read that? Centrist or Scalia? I mean, I saw a graphic somewhere today that showed him more conservative than Antonin Scalia.
I'd be surprised if he were more conservative than Antonin Scalia. I think the big question we don't know, Tom, and we won't know for a while, is whether Neil Gorsuch, and I should say John Roberts, is damned and determined to overturn liberal precedents. Roe versus Wade is a classic example, if they have the votes. That the big fight for the last 30 years on the right has been, you've had relatively conservative judges appointed by, say, Ronald Reagan, Sandra O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, who were sort of conservatives going forward, but they did not have a mission to say, we're going to go back and overturn the Miranda warnings or overturn Roe versus Wade. We think these things are wrong from the 60s. And they'd go right up to the edge of criticizing decisions, including ones on affirmative action, but never in the end overturn those precedents. Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas were ready to overturn liberal precedents. And what I really think is hard to gauge on Neil Gorsuch is, given the chance, would he go back and overturn a 40-year-old decision like Roe versus Wade?
Those are very, very high stakes, the highest stakes for the high court. You put those up against the way Merrick Garland's nomination was handled, and it puts Democrats in some kind of spot here. What are you hearing? Here we are the day after the nomination, the sort of razzmatazz there at the White House. Are they saying absolutely no? Are they saying we can't say no because we complained last year about the avoidance of constitutional duty when Republicans stonewalled and refused even to have a hearing? Are they saying, well, maybe this is a centrist and, oh, you know, we'll fight, but okay, we'll end up saying thumbs up?
My sense is that Chuck Schumer and the Democrats want to put up a fight or determined to put up a fight. They would have put up a fight had, you know, anybody nominated by Donald Trump. They do need, so let's start with that premise. They want to fight. They want to stand strong. The Democratic base wants them to stand strong because of what happened to Merrick Garland. But they also need to find something to object to about Neil Gorsuch, some opinions he's written, some cases he's decided the wrong way from. In other words, they need to find something about him. And that may be apparent a couple weeks from now. It's not apparent to me right now what's going to fuel the opposition to Neil Gorsuch other than the awful treatment of Merrick Garland.
That was a pretty big deal, and a big deal that lasted nearly a year, that's gone on, you know, up until the very end of the Obama administration. David Savage, please stand by with the LA Times. Let's just hear a little bit from Chuck Schumer here. He was talking last week with Jake Tapper on CNN about what the Democrats and what would lead them to block a Supreme Court nominee.
If the nominee is not bipartisan and mainstream, we absolutely would keep the seat open. I'm hopeful that maybe President Trump would nominate someone who is mainstream and could get bipartisan support. We shall see. But if they don't, yes, we'll fight it tooth and nail as long as we have to.
Even threatening there to keep the seat open. You heard that. There have only been 8 justices for nearly a year now since the surprising death of Justice Antonin Scalia. With us right now from Notre Dame in Indiana, professor of law and political science there, Rick Garnett, director of Notre Dame's program on church, state, and society, looks at the role of religious institutions, communities, authorities, and the social order. He clerked for the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist. Rick Garnett, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Stanford in California, Pamela Carlin joins us, professor of public interest law at Stanford Law School. Mm-hmm. Co-director of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic out there, where students work on cases as if before the court. She clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun. Pam Carlin, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do you see Judge Gorsuch as bipartisan and mainstream?
Are you asking me that,
Yes,
Tom?
I am.
It's certainly not bipartisan, and I think mainstream is a meaningless word. It's not bipartisan in any way. It is basically the Republicans having stolen a seat, putting up somebody that they view as a movement conservative. It's telling that, for example, Neil Gorsuch clerked for Byron White and used to write about how Byron White had the courage not to be an ideologue. And then when given the opportunity to talk about his judicial hero on the national stage, he picked Justice Scalia instead.
Does that mean, I understand the complaint about Merrick Garland not being heard, but does that mean that this nominee is, by necessity, not mainstream?
No, I didn't say that.
Mm-hmm, okay.
What I said is mainstream is a meaningless concept when you have the kind of polarization you have both in the country and on the court. I mean, there are some people who are obviously so far outside of any bounds of law that you can't call them even lawyers. But I don't know what it means to say mainstream if we have a mainstream in which both, for example, Stephen Reinhardt, who's an extremely liberal judge on the Ninth Circuit, and Clarence Thomas, who's an extremely conservative justice on the Supreme Court. If they're both in the mainstream, then the word mainstream really doesn't tell you anything.
Rick Garnett there at Notre Dame, what do you think of Chuck Schumer? We'll come back and look in more detail at Judge Gorsuch's record, but this notion of a screen should be bipartisan and mainstream. Does it mean something to you?
No, I agree with Pam that the term has come to be more of a kind of a strategic label that's attached rather than actually a description. I mean, certainly Judge Gorsuch is a judicial conservative, like Justice Scalia, like John Roberts, and so on. Certainly he's intelligent. He's certainly reasonable and accomplished. He's certainly not wild-eyed. To me, that's mainstream. But I think when Senator Schumer uses the term, he might have something else in mind. Maybe just he means acceptable to the Senate Democrats.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's nominee for the United States Supreme Court, Judge Neil Gorsuch, out of the 10 U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Colorado. David Savage covers the High Court for the Los Angeles Times. He's with us from Washington. Pamela Carlin is here from Stanford, a professor there at Stanford Law School. Rick Garnett is with us from joins us from South Bend, Indiana, and Notre Dame, professor of law and political science at the University of Notre Dame. You can join us this hour. Is this the judge for you, for the country now? Do you want the conservative stamp that Judge Gorsuch is sure to bring? How conservative do you think it would be? And when the questions are all over, should the Democrats vote to confirm this man, this judge? Or do you see a stolen seat here after the Republicans' year of stonewalling, of refusing to consider Judge Merrick Garland? Here was Judge Gorsuch last night in the White House.
I consider the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body in the world, and I respect the important role the Constitution affords it in the confirmation of our judges. I respect, too, the fact that in our legal order, it is for Congress and not the courts to write new laws. It is the role of judges to apply, not alter, the work of the people's representatives. A judge who likes every outcome he reaches is very likely a bad judge.
And here was the president introducing Judge Gorsuch.
The qualifications of Judge Gorsuch are beyond dispute. He is the man of our country and a man who our country really needs and needs badly to ensure the rule of law and the rule of justice. I would like to thank Senate leadership. I only hope that both Democrats and Republicans can come together for once for the good of the country.
Rick Garnett, how do you think this judge, if a justice, would change the complexion of the High Court? What would he bring to it?
Well, he'd bring to it, as David said, just a wonderful writing style, and I think a demeanor and a collegial orientation that could be very helpful to that court. It's important to remember that most of the court's work is not 5-4 culture war type issues. Most of the court's work is technical law work, and the justices are unanimous as often as they're divided 5-4. So I imagine that he would be a very capable and talented contributor to the court's work on those cases that are philosophically or ideologically kind of salient. I suspect that his approach would cause him to vote largely in the way that a Justice Scalia or perhaps a John Roberts would vote.
And Pam Carlin at Stanford, how do you see how this judge might change the complexion of the court? What's most important here? Is it about what goes on in those day-in and day-out decisions? Or does it ultimately boil down to the major, major decisions? And as David Savage says, about whether or not we steer toward a court that would overturn liberal precedents and really change not just legal interpretation, but life in this country.
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing, especially with this administration, and I have to say, listening to Donald Trump talk about the rule of law almost makes me gag, since I think he has no commitment to it at all. One of the things that's most important is judicial independence. And one of the things I would like to know about Judge Gorsuch is he prepared to say, as even Paul Ryan did, that Donald Trump's attack on Judge Curiel because he was Mexican was a racist statement.
Mexican by ancestry.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was born in Indiana, which is obviously where Mike Pence is from. And Donald Trump thought a Mexican-American judge is unqualified to judge him because he wants to have a wall. Does Neil Gorsuch think that or not? Because judicial independence is going to be very important going forward. And let me identify one issue that's not a kind of front burner, everybody thinks about it issue, on which Judge Gorsuch, I think, has a very different view and a more troubling view in some ways than Justice Scalia. And that's the question of something that's called Chevron deference, which is the extent to which judges will listen to the expertise of administrative agencies in construing statutes. And I'll give you a very concrete example of this, where it's important, where Justice Scalia came to a result that I don't think he would have picked for himself, but his commitment to Chevron deference ultimately worked to the advantage of
workers.
Chevron
deference, which ultimately goes to executive power, right? It ultimately...
Yes.
Okay.
But it ultimately goes to whether the political system or judges make these determinations, because the administrative agencies are... much more responsive to the political will of the people. So there was a case that our clinic litigated more than a decade ago that was called Smith against City of Jackson. And it involved a very important question, which is, does the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, which prohibits discriminating against workers because they're over the age of 40, does that act contain what's called a disparate impact provision, or does it only forbid employers from deliberately, purposefully discriminating against older workers?
Okay.
And that was an issue on which the law was not on its face entirely clear. But the administrative agency that was responsible for interpreting that law said it covered disparate impact as well. That is, using a practice that has the effect of screening out older workers or denying them opportunities. And Justice Scalia was the fifth vote for that position on the Supreme Court solely because of Chevron deference. So a judge who thinks that Chevron deference should be overruled, and that's something that Judge Gorsuch has said repeatedly, would have felt free to rule against older workers there in a way that Justice Scalia didn't.
David, can I jump in just quickly on that?
Please, Rick.
I take a very different lesson from Judge Gorsuch's views on Chevron deference than Pam does. It seems to me that his willingness to look closely at the work of politically unaccountable administrative agencies suggests precisely the kind of independence that she quite rightly says justices should have. I take it that Judge Gorsuch's view is that law should be made by the politically accountable branch, i.e. the legislature, and that important decisions ought not to be made by agencies who, after all, their administrators don't stand for election. These experts don't stand for election. And, of course, Congress always has the power to enact into law the results of the kind that Pam described. But I think Judge Gorsuch would say if that's the result Congress wants, then that's the result Congress should legislate.
David Savage, I'm seeing reporting here today saying watch out, Republicans, or maybe watch out, President Trump. The Wall Street Journal is saying, Gorsuch is a critic of this legal doctrine that ultimately bolsters executive authority, which in the Trump administration would be, at the very top, Donald Trump. How do you understand where Judge Gorsuch has come down on Chevron deference, which in effect is deference to an executive agency or maybe ultimately to the president here? This is not an inconsequential matter given the kind of strong executive action we've already seen, maybe overstrong, already in the first dozen days of this administration.
Yes, I agree with the importance of it, and I'm closer to Rick's view than Pam's view on this one because, as you said, We now have a situation where Donald Trump's people are in charge of the executive agencies, and they're in kind of make very strong, big changes in the law. And the question is, if somebody goes to court, should judges say, oh, well, we defer to the executive knows best, and we're going to stand back? Or does the judge say, as Judge Gorsuch said, the judge has an obligation to take an independent look at the law and decide whether this executive agency, this executive order, this actually is in line with the law. So I actually think that's a view that many Democrats and liberals should be pleased with. He announced this, by the way, in a decision – he explained it in a decision in August, a case involving an immigrant. And there had been two rules under immigration law. One was that if you came across the border and were caught, you couldn't come back for 10 years and apply for any lawful status. This fellow had a family in Oklahoma. There was another view, part of the law, that said the attorney general can always grant discretion to somebody who has ties to the United States. The law was, at that time in the Tenth Circuit, that the immigrant could make this plea for leniency. But the immigration agency came along and changed the rule and said, this guy, you're out. You have to stay out for 10 years. Neil Gorsuch in the Tenth Circuit overruled the immigration authorities, ruled for the immigrant, and said, in part of his opinion, this violates due process of law to change the law on this person, this immigrant, when he's in the process of – he thought the law was on his side. The government can't do that. And it also says – he said if this was the law, the government in the face of shifting political winds could change the law against disfavored minorities. Now, in my opinion, that's exactly – if you were a lawyer, that's exactly the
– Think about last weekend.
Last weekend, you would want that on your side, saying the government can't change the rules suddenly and hurt all these people. It's a violation of due process of law. So in my opinion, that's actually a good opinion for liberals and Democrats going forward.
Pam Karlan at Stanford, a lot of listeners are going to be thinking about what was not here, the Merrick Garland nomination, not even a hearing there. And, of course, now we have Neil Gorsuch. When you think about if it had been Merrick Garland coming on the Supreme Court instead of perhaps now Neil Gorsuch, how would you describe the delta between the likely outcomes of those two introductions to the court? If it were Justice Garland versus Justice Gorsuch, what's the difference that it would have made for the court, broadly speaking, and for the American people?
Well, there's a short-term answer to that and a long-term answer. In the short term, there are a number of cases that the Supreme Court would decide one way with either a Neil Gorsuch or Merrick Garland. One of the most obvious examples of this is the question whether public sector unions should be allowed to be vibrant players in this country.
Yep.
It was clear right before Justice Scalia died that the Supreme Court was about to really cripple public sector unions. I don't think that would happen if a justice like Justice Garland were on the Supreme Court. I think it's quite likely, the anti-union folks have been spoiling for a fight on this, that within the next year, the Supreme Court's going to confront that issue again. And I have every reason to believe that the court will rule against public sector unions. So that's a big
example. If it's Justice Gorsuch.
If it's Justice Gorsuch,
okay.
That's correct.
There's one.
I think that there are a series of cases about criminal justice issues that might come out differently because of a Judge Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. There, he's done nothing to suggest that he has any real skepticism about the death penalty. I think the Supreme Court is going to see a number of voting rights cases going up to the Supreme Court. Judge Gorsuch has not ruled on any of those cases yet, but during his time on the D.C. Circuit, we've seen that Judge Garland was quite vigorous in enforcing provisions of the Voting Rights Act that came in front of him. And I think especially – so that's in the short term. In the longer
term – Does Gorsuch have a record on voting rights, big issue in this next term?
No, he does not have a track record on that. And I think in the longer term, the main difference is Judge Gorsuch. You're swapping in a 49-year-old
yep.
for Justice Scalia, which means that the Justice Scalia view of the world, a world in which women don't have the right to contraception in their insurance plans if their employer purports to have a religious objection.
And that is the Gorsuch
in which
view.
Women don't have a right to decide whether to terminate a pregnancy or not, in which for all his talk about respecting democratic institutions, Justice Scalia never allowed democratic institutions to have affirmative action plans. Justice Scalia, as far as I know, almost never voted in favor of the plaintiff in voting rights cases. Well, you're now swapping in a younger person who says, that's my view of what constitutional law is. Justice Scalia said in an interview he doesn't think that the Equal Protection Clause really was designed to protect women. He said that's what originalism requires. Mm. So if you have an originalist who's much younger, you are pushing out well into the future Justice Scalia's vision of what the Constitution means. And that vision is just honestly one I don't share.
Rick Garnett, I want to come to you on that. A couple of callers here first, if I may. Sarah in Springfield, Illinois, Land of Lincoln. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I haven't really actually gotten to look up Gorsuch much, but I don't like the idea of an originalist, as he's been described. I think anybody that wants to view our law through the lens of slaveholders and people who didn't give women the right to vote is not the lens I want our law interpreted through.
Mm-hmm.
But second of all, I don't think the Democrats are under any obligation to approve anyone. The precedent for everything is blown out of the water. The Republicans have no ground to stand on with the stance their president has taken by not divesting from any of his businesses, not showing his taxes. And then additionally, with everything they did the past 8 years, obstructing everything, refusing to give a hearing for Merrick Garland, the Democrats could essentially just not do anything and you could take the court back down to 7 justices as it was originally.
Taking a hard line there, Sarah. We hear it. Let me get one more and I'll take it to you, Rick Garnett. But Grant in Austin, Texas. Grant, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think the unfortunate circumstance about where we're at right now is that we're having to play in a situation where logic doesn't really play, because the same rules and the same predicament that we were in a year ago and the argument that was made on the Republican side is now the same one that they're using against the Democrats. And so they have to kind of decide, all right, are we going to want to have a tit-for-tat situation and have retribution, or do we take it on the chin, accept this nomination, knowing that there could be an even more controversial pick down the road? And I think it's...
So what's your bottom line then, Grant? Go with Gorsuch or resist, reject?
If I was picked, I would say go with Gorsuch, even though I would prefer somebody that agrees a little bit more with my personal beliefs.
Yeah.
I think that there could be more hazard down the line. And, I think competency, if you have somebody who has an evidence of people on both sides at least supporting their values and that they're going to adhere to the Constitution, good enough, unfortunately.
Grant, we've got it. I want to go to Rick Garnett before the break. Should this ultimately be, Professor Garnett, about philosophy, judicial philosophy, or about process? You hear Sarah. She says, look, the Republicans blew up precedent. Why should Democrats go with it? She's ready to take the court down to 7 members if necessary. So, the process was already insulted. Why should the Democrats restore it now?
Yeah, I think it's pretty late in the day for anybody on either side to sort of act as though there's any kind of purity when it comes to process here. I mean, each side has been escalating the judicial confirmation process for 30 years, and many of us regret that, but it is what it is, and I don't think it's plausible to imagine.
Wasn't last year a pretty dramatic escalation, or—
It was an escalation, I think. I don't think there's any reason to believe the Democrats would have done any different had the shoe been on the other foot, as
of course,
it is.
They hadn't.
Again, I think it's unfortunate, I think it's unfortunate that the process has become so politicized. And Justice Scalia often spoke about how unfortunate it was, and he tended to blame it on the fact that the court was making itself too important. I wanted to address a little bit, I think it was the first caller, Sarah's point about originalism. I think those who embrace that view of constitutional interpretation, I think they would say it's not a matter of prioritizing the views of slaveholders as such. It's about saying that when you're trying to figure out what a legal text actually means, you need to ask what it meant to those who enacted it, whoever they are. And I think that's a philosophy that's, whether one buys it or not, is certainly respectable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, a strict conservative out of Colorado, 49 years old, and nominated after a seat was held empty for, of course, nearly a year. David Savage is with us from the Los Angeles Times, covers the Supreme Court. Rick Garnett is here from Notre Dame Law School there. Pamela Carlin with us from Stanford Law School. You can join us as well. What should happen here? Nancy Cordes joins us in a moment from CBS News, congressional correspondent there, to really dig into what is likely to happen in the Senate as this is taken up. And, of course, it will be. Republicans are in the majority there. Judge Gorsuch, great admirer of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Here was a speech from last year, April, a couple of months after the death, surprising death of Antonin Scalia. And Judge Gorsuch described the moment he found out about Scalia's death.
A few weeks ago, I was taking a breather in the middle of a ski run with little on my mind but the next mogul field before me when the phone rang with the news. I immediately lost what breath I had left, and I'm not embarrassed to admit that I couldn't see the rest of the way down the mountain for the tears.
The great skier, we're told, double, triple diamond, black diamond, but tears there at the death of Justice Scalia. Last night, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told Brett Baer on Fox News he expects a fight with Democrats over Judge Gorsuch's confirmation, but he said Republicans will win.
If you were in the minority, wouldn't you be fighting tooth and nail?
I might, but Donald Trump won the election. That's why he's making this appointment instead of Hillary Clinton. There's nothing wrong with having a fight. But we intend to win the fight because we've got an outstanding nominee.
Barbara in New York, Endicott, New York. Barbara, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My comment or question is that I noticed that nominated judges' backgrounds and heritages have always been used as a criterion for qualification and examined. I haven't heard anything about Gorsuch's background of wealth and exclusivity.
Donald Trump went on last night about Columbia and Harvard and Oxford. I mean, that was there.
His family has a Vail, Colorado store where a woman's cable sweater sells for $2,700. And I just wonder how, if Trump's a man of the people, the forgotten people, this seems a little... these two facts seem antipathetic.
Yeah, Barbara, we've got it. David Savage, how about that? Thomas Hardiman was on the short list, drove a taxi to work his way through school. That is not the case here. Of course, Judge Gorsuch's mom was head of the EPA under Ronald Reagan for a while, prominent family. It did sound like a gold-plated resume that President Trump celebrated last night at the White House. What about Barbara's question there, David?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't know much about his family background. As I understood, he practiced law here in D.C. for about 10 years, did well, and then went into the Justice Department for a year and then became a judge. So I don't think he's personally made an enormous amount of money other than during the time he was a lawyer. I don't know anything about the family business.
But I mean, this is sort of your Ivy League, precedent continued here. This is not exactly hard scrabble. And Barbara's talking about this populist appeal of Donald Trump on the campaign trail.
Well, that is absolutely the case. I mean, he has he's got a very elite academic background. In fact, all the justices have gone to Ivy League law schools.
Same class at Harvard Law as Barack Obama.
Correct. So, yes, if you mean elite in that sense, yes, he's got a very elite academic background. I don't know, as I was saying, much about his financial situation.
Can we hone in on religion and life for a minute here? Rick Garnett, David reports that in his book on euthanasia, where he comes down ultimately against assisted suicide, Judge Gorsuch writes, "The intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong." On the other hand, he reminds us, some anti-abortion advocates have remained skeptical where he'll come down because he's used the word fetus in some writings rather than unborn child. And then there's the Hobby Lobby decision that he was in the middle of, where they were not required to, for religious reasons, to offer contraception to employees. What about the so-called right to life issue, Rick Garnett and Neil Gorsuch?
Yeah, Judge Gorsuch, as it happens, is a practicing Episcopalian. So among other things, he would diversify the court because there presently isn't a – or there currently isn't a Protestant on the court. Mm-hmm. His book on euthanasia, which was published by Princeton, is an academic monograph. And he's very careful to distinguish between the moral question of the justifiability of assisted suicide and the constitutional question, which is whether states are allowed to regulate it. So it's the fact that he has the view he has about the morality of it doesn't mean, for example, that he would invalidate state laws that permit assisted suicide. Those are different questions. On the use of the term fetus, I don't think it's reasonable to draw inferences about him, his views on the morality of abortion simply from that term. I suspect that his judicial approach would lead him to, you know, to take a narrower view of Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, and he would probably uphold some regulations of abortion that perhaps Judge Garland would have invalidated. And then your final point about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act case and the contraception coverage mandate, I mean, again, that's a case about the interpretation of a statute. His view lines up with what the majority on the court said the statute meant. His view isn't that the Constitution requires exemptions from a law like the contraception coverage mandate, but instead that the congressional statute does. And I realize that's a controversial ruling, but it strikes me as certainly being a defensible and reasonable one.
Pam Karlan, what would you anticipate from a Justice Gorsuch on right-to-life issues, Roe v. Wade, Casey versus Planned Parenthood?
Well, I mean, the president who nominated him said in an interview after he was elected, he guaranteed that the justice he would appoint would be pro-life. And I think there's no indication anywhere in Judge Gorsuch's background on the bench that he thinks women have the right to determine for themselves whether or not to carry a pregnancy to term. My guess is that either he would vote to overturn Roe, which, of course, his judicial hero kept voting to overturn it, or he will whittle it down to a doorstop and allow the kinds of regulations that you saw in Texas that were designed to close every clinic in the state that performed abortions under a spurious claim that it had something to do with women's health. So I don't have any confidence at all that Justice Gorsuch. And remember, once somebody gets on the Supreme Court, they're not bound by precedent in the same way they are on lower courts, that he would have any respect for the existing rules, let alone that he would recognize women's right to contraception as being more important than a for-profit business's ability to claim that they have a religious objection.
There's going to be a fight of some kind. You begin to arm us to understand that fight. Pamela Karlan at Stanford Law School, very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Richard Garnett in South Bend, Indiana at Notre Dame. Rick Garnett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Here are the sound of protesters outside the Supreme Court last night after President Trump's Supreme Court announcement.
Tom, let's gather here.
Chanting for Merrick Garland. Of course, that is history now. Republicans did not act on that. Now Democrats look at the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch. Interview again with Fox News last night. Brett Baer, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, declined to say whether Republicans would use the so-called nuclear option, which allows the U.S. Senate to override a rule or precedent by a simple majority of 51 votes instead of the 60 that would avoid a filibuster.
If you can't get the 8... are you going to use the nuclear option?
Well,
are you going to change the rules?
I'm not going to answer that. Let me just tell you, we're going to get this judge confirmed.
But isn't that answering it?
We're going to get the judge confirmed.
So you would?
We're going to get the judge confirmed. And this kind of campaign goes on these days around every Supreme Court nominee. The Democrats are not going to be in favor of anybody this Republican president would nominate. That's just sort of the way it is.
Of course, Democrats didn't get a chance at a vote, and they remember that. David Savage, stand by there. Nancy Cordes joins us right now, congressional correspondent for CBS News, joins us from Washington. Nancy Cordes, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
If it's going to be a battle, how is that shaping up? Are the Democrats prepared for trench warfare here or something else, Nancy?
Well, they certainly are not interested in making it easy for Republicans. They are still smarting over the loss of Merrick Garland. They call this a stolen seat. They say that President Obama had the right to name the successor to Scalia, and so they're furious that Garland never got a hearing, much less a vote. So they will look to delay. They say they have a lot of questions for Judge Gorsuch. Only a few Democrats have actually come out in opposition and already said that they will vote no. The rest say they have concerns, they're troubled by aspects of his record, but they say they want to ask him questions and they want to learn more before making a decision.
Of course, everybody remembers this, and the Democrats in the Senate most of all. This is Judge Merrick Garland last March in the Rose Garden fighting back tears as he was nominated to the Supreme Court.
This is the greatest honor of my life. Other than Lynn agreeing to marry me 28 years ago. It's also the greatest gift I've ever received, except, and there's another caveat, the birth of our daughters, Jesse and Becky.
And President Obama at his side, talking about then in the Rose Garden as he nominated Merrick Garland, what it would mean if the Senate did not give Judge Garland a hearing and a vote.
It will indicate a process for nominating and confirming judges that is beyond repair. It will mean everything is subject to the most partisan of politics. Everything. It will provoke an endless cycle of more tit for tat and make it increasingly possible for any president, Democrat or Republican, to carry out their constitutional function.
Nancy Cordes covers Congress for CBS News. Is there, Nancy, in Democratic circles, some vision of a kind of last stand that would prevent Judge Gorsuch from getting on the court? Mitch McConnell says affirmatively, you heard him repeatedly there, he will be on the court.
Well, there certainly are a lot of liberal groups and voters who want Democrats to make this a last stand, who want them to hold out as long as humanly possible and block this or any other Trump nominee. Practically speaking, you know, it's very difficult to do something like that for 4 years. And so the reality is that the Democrats probably at some point will either have to give way and allow a vote to go forward, or you'll see Republicans potentially using that nuclear option to reduce the 60-vote threshold down to 51 just to get to a final confirmation vote for Judge Gorsuch. Now, that's something that Republicans are reluctant to do. The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, is not a big fan of changing the rules. He said back in 2013 when Democrats did it, when it comes to cabinet nominees, not a Supreme Court nominee, but cabinet nominees, he said that Democrats would live to regret it, and they have, because now they have much less say in President Trump's cabinet nominees than they would have had they not used that nuclear option. So he knows that this is something that could come back to bite him. The sense I get right now is that, you know, look, there are enough Democrats who are up for re-election in 2018 that
Senate Democrats.
The Senate Democrats who will feel pressure to not look like they're being completely obstructionist, to go along with a vote that it's certainly possible that Republicans at the end of the day, depending on how the confirmation hearings go, and we learned just a short time ago that they'll probably take place about 6 weeks from now, that you could get about 8 Democrats to vote, get to that 60-vote threshold, and proceed without the nuclear option. But that's certainly not something that Democrats are going to be willing to give away right now. Right now, they want to take a stand. They're under great pressure from their party that's furious about all kinds of actions that President Trump has taken in these early days, and they're spoiling for a fight.
David Savage, you're watching this in terms of what the court's work and precedent here. I mean, to stall, Democrats have to stall for 4 years with the hope, I guess, in their case, of a Democratic president to get a different nominee. Republicans did it for just under a year. But if it's less than that, and Gorsuch ultimately goes on to the court, does stalling really matter, David?
I don't think it really does, Tom. I mean, the Democrats are in a very bad situation, as you just described. I mean, you can confirm somebody with 51 votes if they change the rules. I hope the Democrats in these hearings press Gorsuch on two issues. One that Pam mentioned earlier, the independence of a judge. I think one of the most important things going forward with this possible justice and the Supreme Court is whether they will stand up independently, defend the rule of law against the possible actions of the Trump administration. In the past, some of the Supreme Court's greatest moments have been, you remember during the Nixon administration when the Watergate tapes came along, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that Nixon had to turn over the tapes, and that included most all the Nixon appointees who participated.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be very important to know is whether Neil Gorsuch will stand up for the rule of law and go against the president and the administration who—
And two, David, our time is short.
The other one, I think, is voting rights. I mean, it's very important that one of the worst things the Roberts Court done, I think, is sort of ignored voting rights and stood behind money in politics. And I hope they press Gorsuch on money in politics and voting rights and see where he stands.
Nancy Cordes, do Democrats in the Senate think this is the watershed? They're ultimately not going to stop Judge Gorsuch, and this is over the waterfall, maybe even reversal of liberal precedents on Roe v. Wade and more?
You know, I think they're extremely frustrated that they lost a battle of wits with the Senate Majority Leader and weren't able to get Merrick Garland concerned. I was talking to Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut last night, and I said, are you one of those Democrats that's still angry about what happened with Garland? He said, I'm deeply angry, I'm offended, I'm outraged. But there are also Democrats who will acknowledge that they're not going to be happy with anyone who President Trump nominates, whether it is Gorsuch or anyone else. This is not going to be someone who falls in line with their point of view. And so, you know, the endlessly blocking him would only lead to someone else being nominated who they don't like any better.
And there
so
it
they
stands.
They don't have a lot of great options.
Yeah, they don't. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
And David Savage, LA Times. Thank you very much, David.
Thanks, Tom.
This is On Point.